Is it true that evolution's end game is to nullify God?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All of you who follow The Line of Fire know that my academic training is not in science, is not in medicine, that I am not a medical doctor. So, Dr. Brown, no, it's a different doctor. It's a PhD in Semitic languages. And you know that I have not done extensive science in extensive study in science over the years. I've learned over the years some of the major objections raised by atheists. I've learned from Christians who are brilliant scientists, but this is not my area of expertise. So when we talk about these things, we bring on folks who are experts in their field and can speak with authority, can speak intelligently, can be aware of the literature, what the issues are, and can help educate and inform all of us. That's what we're going to do today on The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. If you have a question for my guest, whom I'm about to introduce, call now, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Science, specifically evolution, creation-related questions, 866-34-TRUTH. We're not debating the age of the earth today. I've had on old earth creationists and young earth creationists, but rather we're discussing a new book by Dr. Robert Wilson, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame, A Scientist's Challenge. Dr. Wilson holds his PhD in zoology. He's a retired research biologist with training in anatomy, physiology, and pathology, and he spent much of his 33-year career in the pharmaceutical industry evaluating new drugs for certain infectious diseases and cancer. With that, let's go to our phone line. Dr. Wilson, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, good afternoon, Dr. Brown. Good to talk to you.
You know, we get sent books every week from different publishers and different publicists. How about having this guest on, And it's common with talk radio, so the vast majority we pass by. But when this came in, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame, it did get my attention. So the obvious starting question is, why did you write the book?
Yeah, that gets into a whole complex issue of things. Basically, I wrote the book after about, five, seven, almost 10 years of cogitating on it, of thinking about it. Because in studying what evolution wrote, it was very clear that no one in evolution was going to accept that it might not be possible. It might not be science. So in thinking about it, the obvious question was, what is the end game? What is the final conclusion? What is the logical conclusion of evolution? And quite frankly, the conclusion would be that if everything we see, if all life we see were explainable by a natural process, then why is God needed? And in point of fact, I found a number of quotes which are really stunning, which would support that. Would you like one of them now?
Yes, please.
In our local paper, the Raleigh News and Observer, there was an op-ed article by a Dr. Barash, B-A-R-A-S-H, and he is a evolutionary biologist. He's a professor of psychology, and he is also an unapologetic atheist, according to a local magazine. One of the things he wrote in that article is, quote, "The more we know of evolution, the more unavoidable is the conclusion that living things, including human beings, are produced by a natural, totally amoral process with no indication of a benevolent, controlling creator. That's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah. Now, of course, you've known this for many years. We've all known that there are many champions of evolution who are staunch atheists. And there are the Richard Dawkins of the world writing books like The Blind Watchmaker and The Greatest Show on Earth, basically saying we have all the answers. We don't need anything else. So this is nothing new. But do you feel that there is a fresh, aggressive push in this direction, or that you just are finally confronting now in writing the spiritual battle over evolution?
Well, I don't know if there's a new push. It's a continuing push. Are you familiar with Professor Peter Singer up at Princeton University?
Yes, the ethicist.
Yes. And when he says that human life has no meaning and purpose, and that's because that we all started off from a bunch of inorganic elements, that really got my attention. So the question I have, and I propose to evolution, is where is your evidence that in fact evolution could actually occur? Your biologic evidence showing that the process of one animal evolving to another is actually for real. You know, in science, the big thing there is that you have to have evidence. And everything in evolution is based on reason. It is based on inference. There is not the slightest, I've never found anything wherein evolution has provided the evidence to back up what it says. What that means is that it is an agenda. And so I wrote the book basically to challenge evolution. Where's your evidence? It's almost like a courtroom thing. This is what you say. Where's the evidence for us to support you?
All right. Obviously, there have been other Christian authors who have challenged evolution. I'm sure you've read much of this. What would you say is the unique thing that your book does in bringing the challenge to evolution?
Well, what I did was to try to write my book for lay people who are not familiar with science,
mm-hmm.
to introduce them to what science is actually all about, and then to go from there and go through the three big pictures of evolution. First, abiogenesis, which is life from non-life. The second would be what Darwin actually saw, which is an adaptation response, which is called evolution. And the third is to say, how in the world did new animals come from old? It is a biologically impossible thing. That's what I wanted to make very clear. And then to show them what the outcome of all of that is, because ultimately, if what evolution says is accepted, then that gives a point of attack on all of the faith that we have. And the National Association of Biology Teachers certainly has taken advantage of that, as has the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Those two organizations and others basically say, well, look, anything that depends on a supernatural being, we don't want that taught. We don't want creation taught. And that fits right in with the nine demands that were made by the American Secular Union back in 1885, which basically says if it has anything to do with biology, with biblical work, then we don't want anything to do with it in this country. So it was a warning shot for me, and I wanted to make sure that is firmly understood among people who are interested.
All right, friends, I'm speaking with Robert Wilson, PhD in zoology, his new book, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame. So before we get into some of the most fundamental flaws of Darwinism, of Darwinian evolution, let's lay out what science is and what science is not.
Right. The whole thing about science, to understand it, is that it is a tool. It is a tool to dissect, to describe, to characterize any event in the natural world. It is a very exacting tool. It is a very sophisticated tool sometimes, but that is all that it is just a tool. And one of the big things in science is, as I say, evidence. For example, in July 2012, there was a breakthrough in the physical sciences of something called the Higgs boson, a subatomic particle that was discovered that year. It had been theorized some 40 years before, but it was only found in 2012. What they had done was to build a reactor, a particle accelerator, which was 17 miles in diameter. It went from Switzerland into France and back, circular. And they had been testing and testing and testing with. And then one day, something showed up that was exactly the type of particle that Dr. Higgs had predicted years and years and years before. What that did was to alert everybody that this is a possibility that we have finally found the particle. This is what science is all about. And what did they do then? At that point, they reset the parameters to make absolutely certain that what they had seen was, in fact, that physics particle. And they did. They confirmed it. That's what science is about. It's a characterization of the natural world. So applied to evolution, that's why the whole thing about the process of evolving from one animal to another, from one organism to another, to a new one, becomes so doggone important. Now, what science is not is it's not opinion, it's not consensus. Although it is called that, it all comes down to either you have the evidence or you do not. When I was in the laboratory, one of the things was that we evaluated compounds from chemists. And the thing there was, if we had a hit, something that looked promising, we had to confirm that, we had to take it back, it was evaluated, it was explored, and then they would synthesize some more compounds. It was an iterative process. So in that's what science is about. You make observations, you try and figure things out, and then you set up parameters whereby you can actually demonstrate what's going on.
And even me as a non-scientist hear that description and say, well, then so much of evolution is speculation and not science. And yet in the name of science, it says that you can't say that there's a creator or a God. Where does science get to say that? We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Robert Wilson, retired now, PhD in zoology, biochemist. His new book, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame, to show you where things are really going and why there is such a spiritual battle. It's not to say that every scientist or researcher or professor who believes in evolution is anti-God. It is to say there is an overall thrust of where this naturalism goes, and much of it does have an anti-God foundation. So in the book, after intro and laying out definitions, Chapter 3, A Biogenesis, Evolution's Random Origin of Life. Chapter 4, Adaptation, also known as Darwin's Natural Selection. Chapter 5, Evolution's Achilles Heel, Homeostasis. So let's start there. Dr. Wilson, there's so much to go through in the book, but with limited time, let's jump into Chapter 5 and talk about homeostasis, evolution's Achilles Heel.
Well, you know, when you look at life as the process in a cell, everything that goes on in a cell is regulated. If a protein needs to be made, it gets made. If it has to be destroyed and eliminated from the cell, it's eliminated. But there is this balance inside the cell at all times where all processes are controlled by the cell. That's homeostasis. And when you look at a body, a multicellular body like we are, a human being or any other mammal particularly, you can see that if the blood is a little too acidic, the body corrects that. If it becomes a little too basic, the body corrects that. If, in fact, you get a little too warm, the body corrects that. But when you are talking about moving genetic information so that all of a sudden some new characteristic pops up in an organism, what happens at that point is that if every other physiological parameter is affected by that, if any of them are, then the body has to make an adjustment for that or it is gone because it can't deal with it. And that's the big thing about homeostasis. That parameter, that particular area is not discussed at all by evolution. It is not. And the thing is that when you go from, say, reptiles, which are do not control their own temperature, to mammals, which do control their own temperature, the physiologic change in there is enormous. It begs the imagination, in fact, the number of changes that would have to happen for that to occur. So if you're going to say that mammals evolved from reptiles, well, you better have some pretty good evidence that all of the changes that need to be made in terms of the animal's physiology and being able to control their own temperature have been accounted for. Because remember, the only change that is going to occur occurs when a cell divides and you get a mutation. So you can't just have a single mutation that does that. It's too much.
And got it. There's one book I had, I forget the author, but I think the title is something like Billions of Missing Links. That's not just a missing link, but the more you press the evolutionary structure, you have this endless missing links, and this would be an obvious one. So just to be clear then, there are things science can do and can't do. And you have a leap here where evolutionists have to speculate, but you're saying scientifically it doesn't work. You can't link the things together, or you need an answer as to how it worked. Basically, science could say that a piece of metal could not evolve into a bird because there's nothing in that metal that could evolve into a bird. Science could say that. So when you're pressing scientific definitions on evolution, you're finding it in certain ways to be contrary to science.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And remember, what evolution says is that it is science and it is fact. And that goes back to people like Richard Dawkins that are pressed this on, and also Bill Nye, the science guy, says that. The thing is, they make those claims, but they have no basis to make them. There's no science there. And that's the big thing. And so what happens is, how can they possibly say it's the truth? And yet, you cannot teach creation in schools. You cannot even question evolution's that it might not be true. And at the same time, science would require, you had mentioned abiogenesis. All right. If that is correct, then you have to show in the laboratory that starting from scratch, just inorganic chemicals, you have to create a whole living cell which is capable of reproducing itself and carrying on all the functions. That has never been done. 2,700 papers have been published on how you can get this protein or that protein or possibly some nucleic acid component, but no one has figured out how to put a whole living cell together. And one of the things science requires is that limitation needs to be almost put up in neon lights. It has not been done. It's just speculation.
All right, so let's go from the small to the large. Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Wilson, his book, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame. Let's say some people still have a hard time conceptualizing the cell. It's so tiny. How can so much be going on in there? Which to me, just again, as a non-scientist, I look at that and say, of course, God created the whole thing, obviously. But let's look at bigger picture, let's look at a giraffe. You have a chapter on that.
Yes.
And a giraffe is what? Can be over 10 tons, you know, the tallest animal, the whole bit. Why does a giraffe work against the theory of evolution?
Well, because there's no explanation of how it occurred. Again, remember the whole mechanism of evolution are single mutations which are totally accidental, purposeless. Now, when you get to the giraffe, you're dealing with an animal that has a neck that goes on, what, 12 to 16 feet up. You have a heart that has to push blood up into its head to get to the brain, and the blood pressure of giraffes are enormous. If a human being had a blood pressure like a giraffe has, you'd be in the emergency room, and it would be almost like a stroke. So it's not just the lengthening of the neck. It's the lengthening of every organ that goes up in the neck, all the nerves, the blood vessels, everything else to take care of that higher pressure. And that just doesn't happen by random. In fact, there was an article I read where an author who was an evolutionist, he questioned, he said, why don't we look at the whole animal? There's a problem here. And the whole animal is not looked at. They look back at fossils. So here's an early giraffe, short neck, longer neck, longer neck. And now we have this one here. Well, how in the world, physiologically, did that occur? There is no explanation whatsoever. And biologically, there is none to be had. It just is impossible.
All right. So this sounds so clear, so compelling. I've not heard strong answers from evolutionists in terms of when they're challenged with something like this. But you got your PhD, was it Rutgers University?
Yes, it was.
All right, so PhD in zoology. I'm sure you studied with people that had different worldviews and things like that.
Yep.
What if we had Richard Dawkins on, if we had Bill Nye on or someone else, and we brought up the giraffe, how would they respond to what seems to be an obvious problem?
I think that would be a very interesting question, and the answer is I don't know. They would probably avoid it if they could, because they are not trained in any kind of physiology. As I said, any of the evolution books I have, and one particular one that had five authors, beautiful book by the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium group, they don't touch that kind of thing. It is all the same thing. We start here, and we go to this animal, we go to that animal, we go to that animal, but there's no hesitation. There's no what if. There's no skepticism. And the point is, they could not, Bill Nye could not explain that. He would look at what he calls evolution, not him particularly, but what is characterized as evolution. For example, the blowfly, if it's treated with diazinone, it's killed, except a few of them do escape. And because diazinone is a mutagen, it knocks out the enzyme which would normally be affected by it. And so all of a sudden you've got this new population come up. They're resistant to diazinone. And all of a sudden you've got, well, there's evolution. You see that? No, that has nothing to do with evolution. Let's keep a clear definition of what it is. You start off with inorganic elements at the beginning. Those somehow form a first cell, which then somehow goes along and forms all the organisms that are on the Earth today, and that would include us. We come from inorganic elements, but yet there is absolutely no evidence to support that.
Mm. And when you bottom line it, evolution has no explanation for the origin of matter. Evolution has no explanation for the origin of life. Evolution
Yes.
has no explanation for the origin of self-consciousness that human beings uniquely experience. And we have answers for all of them scripturally and before God. Hey, Dr. Wilson, we're out of time, but
Surely.
Thank you for taking the time to write this book. And friends, I hope that as you're listening and watching, you'll pick this up, Nullifying God, Evolution's Endgame. We just scratched the surface today. All right, we'll be right back with a radical change in topic going to talk about money, money in the gospel, an angle you haven't thought about.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, delighted to be with you, and I want to talk to you about money, money and the gospel, but perhaps from a perspective that you may not be familiar with. You may not be used to hearing, and I think it's going to get you thinking, all right? If you have a question for me, phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. In fact, Howard, whatever in the world people want to ask me about, I may get to some random calls unrelated to the subject at hand. So phone lines are open. Any question you want to ask, 866-34-TRUTH. First, let me read to you from 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul, after exhorting slaves and masters, says this in verse 3, if anyone teaches other doctrine and does not agree with the sound teaching of our Lord Jesus the Messiah and with the teaching that promotes godliness, he is conceited, understanding nothing, but has a sick interest in disputes and arguments over words. From these come envy, quarreling, slander, evil, suspicions, and constant disagreement among people whose minds are depraved and deprived of the truth, who imagine that godliness is a way to material gain. So he is speaking of people who are divisive and destructive and in the flesh and sinful, and says these people also think that godliness is a way to material gain. Now, I think of precious brothers and sisters around the world who are suffering for the gospel at this moment. I think of those who have lost everything for Jesus. I think of those who have literally been killed for their faith, people that I know personally for the gospel. I think of those who live with deprivation in an ongoing way to bring the gospel to others who don't know Jesus. And it is not laughable, it is pitiful that some people think that godliness is a means to financial gain. You say, but wait a second. What about the guy that used to be an alcoholic, that gambled away his money and drank away his money, left his family destitute, went from job to job, and then got radically born again, got free from alcohol, got free from gambling, became a devoted father, a devoted husband, a hard worker, lived by biblical principles, was frugal and generous, and ended up becoming wealthy all through the gospel? No one's disputing that. And there are many wonderful scriptures about generosity and God's blessing on those who are generous. And there are many wonderful scriptures about hard work and the ethic of hard work and being good stewards and being frugal. So amen to that testimony. Let it be multiplied a million times over. That does not negate that it is a corrupt attitude to think that godliness is the means of financial gain. It is one thing to say that godly living bears fruit in many different areas. It is another thing to think, oh, if I get saved, I can get rich. Oh, if I follow Jesus, I can get wealthy. That is corrupt and ugly and destructive. So far, I'm not saying anything controversial, I hope. This is basic Bible. And then Paul says this, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world and we take nothing out. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with these. Then he says this, but those who want to be rich, not talking about someone said, Lord, I'd love to live on 10% of my income so I can give 90% to you. Lord, I'd love to be able to give millions of dollars to the gospel. Lord, I'd love to be able to feed the poor in my community. No, those who want to be rich, in other words, riches is the goal, not generosity, not giving, not serving, not helping. Riches is the goal. Those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And by craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierce themselves with many pains. But you, man of God, run from these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. Then a little bit later in the chapter, 1 Timothy 6, beginning in verse 17, Paul writes this, instruct those who are rich in the present age not to be arrogant or to set their hope on the uncertainty of wealth, but on God, who richly provides us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do what is good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good reserve for the age to come so that they may take hold of life that is real. All right. Here's what I want to pursue with you. And this is on the heels of a conversation I had with one of our missionaries serving in Peru, grad from our ministry school, serving with his wife in Peru. And we were talking about the carnal prosperity message. We were on his podcast talking about my new book, Playing with Holy Fire, talking about the chapter, the pep talk, Prosperity Gospel, and then talking about a healthy attitude towards money. Because there has often been a poverty mentality associated with the gospel, because of which the less I have, the holier I am. That's the mindset. We used to joke about it in the church where I got saved. They said, yeah, the pastor's so holy, he has holes in his shoes. And the mentality of the church leaders or the elders or the deacons, whoever set the pastor's salary, was you gave him a low salary to keep him humble, and that was helping him be spiritual. As much as the Catholic Church has much money and massive amounts of money, still priests take on a vow of poverty in the priesthood. And we all agree that it is profane and ugly and despicable when you have some pastor or some TV preacher or radio teacher, whoever, that in manipulative ways raises funds for his or her ministry in order to get rich personally. It's one thing if God blesses you with an inheritance or through your hard work in ministry, money comes in to support your family, and God blesses you with extra. It's fine to have a nice home. It's fine to have a car, better have a car that runs than a car that breaks down. I found that I was no holier living in a small rundown place than a nice big place. I found that I was no holier having a car that didn't run versus a car that did run, okay? These are all tools. We don't put our heart in earthly things, but we don't major on that. But here's what I want to challenge you with, all right? I want you to think about something. We all agree, or let's just say, those of you with whom I'm in communication, we all agree on the abuses of the carnal prosperity message, a message that David Wilkerson said was birthed in the pit of hell. And when I was once talking to him about it, I said, hey, you said that the modern prosperity message was birthed in the pit of hell. He said it was. So this is something that we feel very strongly about, this idea that Jesus died to make you rich, or the good news that we preach to the poor is that you can be rich and that you should put a picture of a Rolls Royce on your refrigerator and confess that until you own it. That is ridiculous. That is nonsense. And if you get that Rolls Royce, I'm not going to say, well, it must have been the Lord. Okay? I'm not saying that God never gave anyone a Rolls Royce. I'm just saying that if your means of getting it is, well, Jesus died to make me rich, and I'm going to go after riches, and the more I have, the more spiritual it proves. That's corrupt. I was at a meeting years ago, and I didn't get to my controversial point yet, where I really want to go with this. I was at a meeting years ago in England where I was speaking, and the speaker one night, I didn't go that first night, just flown in and was resting, but my colleague went, and he was shocked by the message. And one thing this pastor said, this pastor and TV minister said, was that, and he was a person of color, just happened to be, and he said that white men come in his home to work on the house or something, and they're shocked to see a black man living like that. And he said it proves that there's a God in heaven, that he has a house like that. And I said to my colleague who reported on this, I said, so let's say next door to him is a mafia guy, some criminal who's gotten rich illegally and has got an even bigger home. What does that prove? That there's a devil in hell? Come on. Many of the saintliest people that I know have very little in this world. Many of the saintliest people I know could care less about possessions in this world and are willing to leave everything to follow Jesus any day. At the same time, now is where I want to dig a little bit, all right? We can have an unhealthy poverty mentality. So you tell me which is better. Well, you know, I want to be really careful with funds, and I want to make sure I watch every dime. Commendable attitude. Trust me, the money that comes in our ministry, I'm very jealous that it's used properly, that people who give know that their funds are being used rightly. I'm very jealous of that, all right? But you can have this mentality. You can be so careful and you get a little extra. You almost feel bad for it, and you don't want to get a something better that works better so you can communicate better to people, or a car that runs so you can get to your meetings on time because you don't want to get worldly. And so you have a poverty mentality. And because of which, people probably that work near you, they don't have enough. And then probably you give very little to help others because you have so little coming in. Then you have some other ministry, and maybe they talk about money a little too much. And maybe they overemphasize God's abundant supply a little bit. We're not talking about just carnal prosperity messages. Let's say you got this one swings this way on the pendulum a little too far. You got this one swings a little too far. But because they have this vibrant faith, and because they believe that God's a generous big God, that they give millions of dollars every year to missions, and they take better care of their staff and employees, and they are generous to a fault, helping those in their community with genuine needs. So you get the one wants to be so careful, doesn't want to dishonor God, and every little penny and extra comes in, like I said, you're almost ashamed of it, and oh, that's extra, what are we going to do with it? And then you are not a good conduit for finances. You are not a good conduit for giving. And the other is like, hey, I don't care if I have a nice house, small house, doesn't matter. But right now I've been blessed with a nice car. You know, hey, it doesn't matter to me. It's just a car, but I get around better. And this person has a certain attitude towards money. And they end up giving away tons of money to help other people in ministry. In fact, the guy kind of with the poverty mentality, they support him. And you think, okay, you know, we want to be so careful and honoring to God, but sometimes we don't honor him in other ways, because of which we are not conduits. God can't trust us with riches because we have a poverty mentality. The other person that we're criticizing is generous and gives and is not caught up in material things. Yeah, the carnal prosperity message, that's corrupt, that's destructive, that's harmful. We utterly reject that. But there's an attitude of generosity and faith that generates funds for the kingdom. And that's a good thing. That's healthy. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So I want to challenge your thinking here for a minute. If you're a pastor, if you're a ministry leader, if you're a businessman, businesswoman, if you are someone just getting started in ministry work, want to go on the mission field, if you're a college student, wherever your background, I want to challenge your thinking for a little while, all right? I first spoke at Gateway Church in Grapevine, right? That's right, Dallas, Texas. Pastor Robert Morris, whom we're praying for complete recovery of a real serious health attack he recently had. I first spoke there about 14 years ago, 14 and a half years ago. I know precisely because it was a weekend when our second grandson was born. And I was curious to see how much they talked about money. Why? Well, I'd heard of the church from a friend of mine that was serving in the ministry there. Told me how it had grown rapidly and now was maybe several years old. It had over 3,000 people. Today it's probably what, 35,000 people, one of the largest churches in America. And I had been sent Robert Morris's book, The Blessed Life. And if I didn't know the person that sent me the book, it was a personal friend of Pastor Morris, I would have thought, stories here are crazy. Gave all these cars away, gave away everything he had. God gave this. I mean, it's really happened. And anyway, I was curious to see with a strong message of generosity that the church preached, how much time they took on the offerings. I wanted to see. I was curious. So the first weekend, it was two Saturday night services, and then it was three Sunday morning services. That was the schedule. So five services I was going to speak in. And my custom is, when there are multiple services in a weekend, that normally the first one I'll be in from beginning to end. I'll be in through all the worship, through all the announcements, and then preach. And then the other services I'll be in for part of them. Obviously, you're busy. There's a lot going on that weekend when you're speaking that many times. Sometimes you just need to come back and rest a few minutes between services. And then I don't like it to be a monotony where I sing the same songs every time and tire of anything. So the first service, I'm there from the first minute until the last. And I get introduced to speak, and I think, what happened? They didn't receive an offering yet. I was curious to see how much time they spent on it. Did they overemphasize money? Did they push hard? And I thought, they didn't receive the offering. How's this worked? Did they do it now? What? So I figured, okay, they'll receive the offering at the end of the service after I preach. That's odd. So I finished the message. We do the altar ministry, whatever. And then the pastor, Pastor Robert, wasn't there. He was traveling back that day. Another pastor gets up, and he dismisses the people. And he said, oh, if you're visiting, the way we give, we have boxes in the back. I thought, you didn't even receive an offering. You didn't say a word about money the whole time. Now, I believe maybe once in a year, Pastor Robert would teach about biblical principles on giving or something like that. Or maybe through a membership class, they'd lay out some of what they believe, or people would get the book. But in the service, they didn't even receive an offering. Now, I believe to this moment, among mega churches in America, that per capita, far and away, Gateway has the highest giving rate of people in the congregation. Now, they're also in a wealthy area near in Dallas, greater Dallas, Grapevine. And they've got people coming there, CEOs and athletes and different ones, and higher salaries, etc. But per capita, they have the highest giving rate. And as of, I'm going back now, about 3 years, maybe a little longer, they were giving away $1 million a month to missions. $1 million a month to missions. And remember, they don't pass the plate. They don't receive offerings in the service. All right? So in the book, The Blessed Life, Robert talked about three different types of mentality. The poverty mentality, the prideful mentality, and the grateful mentality. I think those are the three words he used, but I have the substance of it. Read the book years back. So if you have a poverty mentality, let's just say that God blessed you with a good car, a nice car, and it's best car you had. A rich friend, said, hey, I want you to have this, man. Your car is always breaking down. You're late for work and stuff, and I have a car dealership. God's blessed me abundantly, and I just want to bless you with this car. Brand new car. It's yours. It's paid for. And you're driving that car, and I come up to you, and I say, hey, man, that's a nice new car. Beautiful. And you say, no, look, someone gave it to me. I don't deserve something like that. That's a poverty mentality. And I realized, because I've been so careful in ministry over the years, I've been so conscious about salaries. I've been so conscious about the fact that people are giving, people with little money are giving, people are giving sacrificially to help our work. And you don't want to have too much. And even though we've had nice homes and things like that through you know, real estate, you know, just prospered or whatever, or a family member, you know, we inherited money and we're able to get a nice piece of property, whatever it is, I feel like I always had to explain it. I thought, wait a second, if God blessed me with the thing, I should just be thankful. I'm generous. Our ministry gives. We believe God for funds. We're always stretched out. You know, there's always another ministry project. God moves on you today to send us $100,000. We'll use $100,000 probably within a week for ministry projects. Trust me, we are stretched out and we support workers all around the world. And yet I realized in a subtle way, yeah, I kind of had that mentality. Even though at times we've had nice things, and yeah, I've kind of had that mentality. then he talked about the prideful mentality. So same deal. You got this brand new car. Maybe you earned it. You get this brand new car. And I come up to you and say, that is a nice car. That's a beauty. And you say, you should see my Lamborghini at home. This is nothing. I just drive this to work because I don't want to get nicks. That's a prideful mentality. But the grateful mentality, hey, that's a beautiful car you got. Yeah, thank God, isn't it? The Lord really blessed me with this. And that's the kind of mentality. It's just, this, the thing itself, that's not the big deal. We're just passing through this world. Having things, not having things is not the sign of spirituality. We're not to put our trust, our heart, our desire in earthly riches and love those things. So if you have a lot, great, rejoice in it. If you have little, great, rejoice in that. Paul said, though, I know how to abound. I know how to be exalted. And I know how to be abased. I know how to have a lot. I know how to have a little. Some of us know how to have a little, but we don't know how to have a lot, because of which we are not as blessed as we could be with the ability to help others. That's the whole thing I'm talking about, with the ability to help others and bless others and be a conduit to others. So here I'm really spiritual. I kind of have this poverty mentality. And God sees he really can't trust me with a multi-million-dollar budget, because I'm going to either be apologizing for it the whole time or feeling guilty about it or afraid to use it. And then the prideful one, God can't bless that person and trust them with multi-millions because it's all about them. But then there's someone else that has a spirit of generosity and faith and says, yeah, Lord, I'm believing for millions of dollars for the gospel. And in the process here, let's say that you have a goal to have a multi-million-dollar business because you want to fund feeding programs in the inner cities of America, or you want to rehab the educational system and it's going to take money, or you want to support missionaries going into tribal regions in India. And you say, Lord, give our company $100 million, Lord, and we will be generous. Give our company $1 million, whatever it is. And whatever you start with, when he gives you $10, you immediately give the first fruits to missions. You prove yourself to be good stewards. You prove yourself to be people of faith and all this, right? And in the process, maybe your company goes from $100,000 a year to $20 million a year. And with that, you end up getting a nicer car. Okay, but that's not the goal. That's not the goal of it. That wasn't the goal of a nicer car. And you're not going to have this endless process of it's got to be the best, a new Lamborghini every month. No, that would be, now you've become covetous, worldly, carnal, if that was the case. But the idea that as God is blessing your business, and the whole reason you've been praying for blessing on your business is so that you can fund the gospel more. Boy, I love our church. I love our pastor, but there's so little funds there. Everybody's squeezed, and the youth pastor has to work three jobs, and the children's pastor doesn't have enough money to put food on the table for the kids. We want to do better. I want to help out the church. I want to give with generosity. Can we be trusted with funds? Or do we have the poverty mentality because of which God can't trust us with an abundance because we don't know how to handle it, and we aren't going to be able to pour it out on others? Or do we have the prideful mentality where we become covetous and greedy and think that it's all about me? Or do we have a spirit of gratefulness and generosity that says, Lord, we're here to be a blessing. And these are just earthly things. This doesn't make us. Money doesn't make us or break us. We serve you, not mammon. So Lord, entrust us with whatever you want. Money itself is not sinful. The love of money is sinful. And trust us with an abundance. These are tools. And we want to use these tools to further the gospel. And maybe if you have a little bit better car when you go to your business appointments, you can take people out for lunch better and associate with certain people. And it's just a tool. It doesn't go to your head. And you get a few better suits and outfits to interact with certain people because you're going to meet with certain people and certain prominence. And you begin to do that. And you begin to bring in more money. And you begin to give away more money for the gospel. And you live a godly life. Isn't that a good thing? Let's not get so spiritual about money that we become unspiritual when it comes to it. Hey, I hope this helps. Back with you on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday tomorrow.